Need a volunteer. Roger, you look like a good volunteer. Come here a second. He's going, uh-oh. Have you noticed that those of you who have traveled to different places, that the concept of personal space is very different in other cultures, in some cultures? You know, most people in sort of the West and the North tend to have a fairly defined space. Is that true? Where I come from in the Caribbean, many places of Latin America, some parts of Asia, in Africa, personal space is differently defined. Look at Roger start to move back. Thank you, Roger. Thank you. So up close and personal can mean very different things to people. I have to tell you, though, even though I'm from Barbados and used to that, I have to tell you about an experience where I had up close and a little too personal, even for me. You know, I spent some time in Kenya, and one of the ways in which you get around in Kenya is through a network of, they're sometimes hard-pressed to be called taxis. They're hardly roadworthy sometimes, but they're called matatus. And the slogan that I came very quickly to understand is that a matatu is never full. Now, that sounds like an oxymoron in a sense, but because they're only defined amount of spaces, but I learned that I was terribly wrong. And learned this the hard way one time when I was taking a trip from Sika, where I was based, to Chagoria, further north. And so I got on, you know, at the station and got into the matatu, which is basically like a jeep with a cabin in the back, and there's a conductor and the driver and so on, and sitting down, and I got my seat because I was one of the first ones in. I'm feeling pretty good, and we're on the way. And people are stopping and getting on, and that's pretty good. It's pretty full now. Well, lo and behold, we get to the next stop, and there's more people there, and he's beckoning people to come on. I said, where are you going to fit these people? Come on in. This woman gets in, well represented in all of her flesh, abundantly situated, with a chicken and her basket. She was obviously quite tired because she pushed her way through the people to where I was sitting on my little bench minding my own business. I'm not going to do it to you, but got her chicken and her basket, proceeded to turn around, adjust herself, and sat right on me. Right on my lap. I was taken aback. And not only that, but she decided to be very comfortable and lean back on me. So my face was right up against her back. And the chicken is going like this. It was a live chicken. And I thought, you know, I'm used to being really close to people. I like hugging people, you know that. But this was a little too up close and personal, trust me. Anyway, not only that, but it was a little uncomfortable because for the journey and the roads were bumpy, my legs were sore. When it came time for me to get off, I'm telling you, I looked like a hobbling cripple because I could barely walk and so on. Up close and personal. I think that our scriptures today invite us to this place, this uncomfortable place, this place that pushes us beyond the boundaries. We begin with Jeremiah, and it is God this time who has decided to get up close. And the message that I'm asking and posing today, up close, but how personal? Because up close might talk about the physical proximity. Personal talks about the experience and the vulnerability of enter into what that might mean. So you can be close, proximately close to people or to situations or issues, but not personally engaged, not experiencing, not vulnerably disposed and connected to it. There's a difference. God takes the initiative in the book of Jeremiah. We've been studying this in our Bible study over the past few weeks, actually, the book of Jeremiah. It's really been very much of an emotional roller coaster. The people have been unfaithful. Jeremiah has been prophesying and railing against them, and yet he moves between the hope as well as the judgment of God, as it were. And in this part of the scripture in Jeremiah 31, it's part of what's called the book of consolation. And God in his ultimate freedom, as only God is able to be, God is rightfully entitled to be angry with what has happened, with the way they have treated the people, the way they have disobeyed the commandments and fallen into political ruin. They've disgraced, as it were, the temple by worshiping idols there. They've brought ill will and ill perception to the reputation of God. God is angry. And yet in this particular text, God has chosen out of God's own freedom, God's wounded commitment and love to come near to them and to start over, start afresh, as it were. So the scriptures tell us that no longer will one person teach another, I'm going to put my law in your hearts. It's not a different law. God's intention has always been that the people honor God only, that there be no idols, that they respect each other, love one another, care for each other, not murder each other, provide for the weak and the orphan, lift up those who are downcast. It's always been that way. But now what is different is that the prophet is saying God is going to come and emblazon that law in the heart, going to make it personal. Now, we need to stop there before we gloss over what that might mean. The metaphor of writing the law on tablets, no longer will they be written on stones, but on their heart. When you write the law on stones, what do you have to do? What do you have to do to get markings on stone? You got to chisel it in. That's right. You got to chisel it in. I don't think this is some innocuous, benign kind of entry into our heart. I believe it has to do with either tattooing or branding his law on our heart. Now, that's not comfortable. So although it is motivated by God, it's going to cost us. It's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be up close and very experientially personal. And the reason is, there are four things in that particular text that suggest that God's motivation is in order that the people be in solidarity with each other. It is in order that each person will have full knowledge of God, that each person will experience God in a deep and a profound way. It is so that the people will recognize that they are on equal footing with God. We are a culture, we are a people, we are a race preoccupied and in love with divisions. Don't you notice that? How are we different from each other? How are we set against each other? We are just enamored with divisions, always separating. God is putting a kind of law that will recognize, help us recognize we are equal before God. And lastly, and most significantly, God is going to, the last part of that verse, is going to forgive their sins. God is going to forgive their sins. God is a God of forgiveness. Forgiveness, we have so misunderstood it. Forgiveness is not a condoning of what has happened. It is not an ignoring of what has happened. Forgiveness suggests that some wrong has been done, a grievous wrong even, an egregious wrong, but that wrong will not be the last word. So these people have mocked God. They have disobeyed God. They have treated each other with not only hatred and disrespect, but that will not be the last word, for God is doing a new thing. God has come up close and personal in the hearts of the people. And the promise is for those who dispose themselves to God, this is what will happen. This creates hope and a new reality. And it is so good that God takes the initiative, because the second reading from Psalms is an invitation for us to get up close and personal with ourselves. Psalm 51, thought to be the occasion on which David offers his confession for his relationship with Bathsheba and sending her husband Uriah to the front to die and trying to cover it up. And he's overcome. And this psalm, he pours out his heart. It is a psalm, and that's why I used it today for our common confession, because it is something that we are called to live into and to speak out of ourselves. And what we learn from David is a courage, because we're struck by the candor the candor and the contrition. He is blazoned. He is open. He is true and honest about what he has done. You know, we know in the political speak, all kinds of ways to find spin and avoid things. Isn't that true? Isn't that right? When a gaffe is committed, too often we say, well, I was misquoted, or I was misinterpreted, or I misspoke. I misspoke the veracity of the statement. I love that one. In other words, you lied. You know, we find these ways to get around and to squirm out from underneath the implications of our doings. Not this king. Not this David. This David says, I have sinned. And throws himself on the mercy of God. Listen to the words that he uses. These are they're not violent words, but they are instructive. They are invasive words. Create in me. Restore me. They call for some upheaval. So David is getting up close and personal with himself. And it's an invitation for us to do the same. How honest are we with ourselves and with our understanding of why we do what we do? For he not only confesses his acts, but he talks about his disposition. I need to say a few words about this because it's too often misunderstood. He says, it must be, he says, that from my mother's womb I have been sinful. A lot of people are thrown off by that and upset by that. It doesn't sound very good. How can a little baby, beautiful little babies and children, how can they be sinful? What David is doing is recognizing what every human community, and in their literature, in their art, in their music, in their life and interactions with each other, have borne testimony to, is that there's something fundamental about being human that disposes us to do the wrong thing. However you want to say that and articulate it, it's true. Joan Chichester, a Roman Catholic sister who teaches, a great spiritual writer, talks about the fact that we have created an illusion about perfection. Perfection becomes a tyrant, and we are all the more devastated when we don't measure up because we have the wrong goal. And she counsels us to recognize that part and parcel of our humanity is our flawedness. That's the way it is. And David recognizes this. He's not wallowing in it. It's not a preoccupation with a morbid sense of human disposition. But he's stating the truth. What does Paul say in Romans 7? The things that I know I ought to do, I do not. The things I know I should not do, I do them. And I can't seem to stop. And you and I know if we do an appropriate, truthful inventory of our lives, that that's the truth. And so David is confessing a disposition, even as he is confessing what he is doing. But he says, that's not the last word. Augustine talked about human beings as those who can't but not sin. No, those who sin. I forget what it was. I'll have to get back to that one. His point is that we are people who do sin. That's part of our nature. The question becomes then, what do we do with that? And up close and personal means facing that reality about ourselves, being truthful about how we break relationship with each other, with ourselves and with God. Be honest about that. Speak of it. Name it. Because when you do and bring it to light, it loses its potency. It's when we secretly try to project an image of ourselves so other people would like us and approve of us that we get trapped and all the more mired in what is wrong. When we are dishonest and disillusioned. And so that is why God comes close to us, as we read in Jeremiah, to draw out the truth. That is why that inspires us, like David, to draw close to God and to ourselves, to experience ourselves fully. Because don't we long, let's be honest, don't you long to be known and loved for who you are, just the way you are, not who you have to pretend to be? Don't you long? I do. With all my warts and problems
and foibles. I want God to love me as I am, but not to leave me there. And that's what David is doing. Saying, here it is, God. Here's the raw truth about me, about what I've done and what I seem to be like. Now, create in me a clean and pure heart. Restore me. Don't abandon me. Cleanse me with hyssop. Use what is necessary to make me into the kind of servant and person you want me to be. And recognizing this is an ongoing process by God's grace. That's the good news. God's not giving up. Too bad for you. You turn your back on God, you turn around right there. You turn back right in front of you. Turn to the side. God's not giving up. Can't get away. You think you're shifty and smooth operator in your mind? You want to reject, you turn your back, say, forget it, God, I need a break from you. The good news, it doesn't seem that God takes a break from us. And then we come to the gospel. And this is where, in many ways, the rubber hits the road. This season of Lent is a prime opportunity. That's why you notice in consumer culture, there's no equivalent with the season of Lent, is there? Right? There's no equivalent. Because it is preoccupied with understanding the meaning of death. And principally, for the Christian community, the death of Jesus. And that doesn't sell well. This text in Passover, we're told that some Gentiles come from the region where Jesus maybe spent a lot of time. They come to Passover. They haven't come to worship necessarily. They haven't come to join in as God-fearers, perhaps at the temple sacrifices like some Gentiles did. They have come to what? To see Jesus. They've come to see Jesus. We don't know exactly what they want to see. What we do know, though, is that the appetite among the people beyond the Jewish nation has been growing because the things that Jesus has done has drawn them. Just the verse before, the Pharisees are complaining that all the world has gone out to him. We can't seem to stop not only Jews but Gentiles from going to this Jesus. And then we have the story, the Greeks come, we want to see Jesus. Well, what is it they want to see? Jesus is not interested in cult worship. He's not interested in a following for following's sake. He's not interested in people who are mesmerized by his miraculous. He wants them to see the truth. If you want to see Jesus, well, see me as I am, not as you want to put your notions on me. So what does he say? Things that don't seem to make sense. We don't even know if they actually got to see him. They approached Philip. Philip's name is Greek. And so they thought, well, maybe he can get us in, as it were, get us close to Jesus. And Jesus responds by talking some weird stuff. Unless a seed dies, it'll be alone. It's when it dies that it bears much fruit. You want to see me? The only way for us to see Jesus truthfully is through the prism of his death first. Although we are called an Easter people, we have to begin with his death. It's the meaning and the understanding and the purpose and the ramifications of his death that helps us to see Jesus. It helps us to see our lives and see what we may make of them by God's grace. It is for this that I have come, Jesus said. And it says some other weird stuff. That if you love your life, that's not the way to go. But unless you hate your life, if you hate your life, now again, don't get all bent out of shape. You know, Jesus telling us to hate our lives. Oh, my life sucks. Not inviting us to some kind of self-pity. That's not, Jesus is engaging, as we have said before, in hyperbole, Jewish hyperbole, to help us appreciate what is going on. What Jesus is saying is that except you hate that about your life which prevents you and keeps you from the deeper things of service and generosity and hope and faith. Hate those things that get in the way of you being truly human. Hate those things that prevent you from seeing and experiencing me in all of my glory and the implications of my death for this world. Hate that stuff. But if you love me and hate that about your life that's getting in the way, then my Father in heaven will honor you. For when I am lifted up, if you want to see me, Jesus says, you want to see me? You want to see me? Al Pacino? See me? Then you got to look up on a cross. It's faithfulness to the agenda of God meant that those forces that be will inevitably kill him. Because Jesus came to turn upside down the way we have organized our lives politically, socially. There's nobody over and above anybody else in this view of things. You don't have to jump through hoops to get to God. Those who want to control life, agents of the empire telling you who you must see and what you must do in order to be approved. Because the cross is that aperture, that window that opens up for us the possibilities of using our lives for the good of the world that God so loves. And we don't get there until we understand that that is the only way to do it, is Jesus' way, and it's going to cost you and me. I want to share and close with the words of great prophet of our day, I believe. Bono. About 3 years ago, Bono was invited to the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington. And it was when he was part of his campaign to try to draw attention to the dire situation in the continent of Africa and what was happening. And even today, we see that is still on the table. The G20 is going to be meeting, and we've just heard that the agenda is not going to include particular strategies and commitments for the poorest of the poor. The agenda is going to be consumed by fixing our economy. Why should the least of these have to pay for the mistakes of the rich of these again and again? The issues of justice are front and center in the cross. Front and center, not sidelined. Anyway, Bono is talking, and I quote from him as he's talking to President Bush, the then President Bush, and others who would gather. And he said, "It's not about charity after all, it's about justice. And that's too bad because Americans are good at charity. They like to give and give a lot, even those who can't afford it. But justice is a higher standard. Africa makes a fool of our idea of justice. It makes a farce of our idea of equality. It mocks our pieties. It doubts our concern. It questions our commitment. 65,000 Africans are still dying every day of preventable, treatable disease. For lack of drugs, we buy at any drugstore. Preventing the poorest of the poor from selling their products while we sing the virtues of the free market, that's a justice issue. Holding children to ransom for the debts of their grandparents, that's a justice issue. Withholding life-saving medicines out of deference to the Office of Patents, that's a justice issue." A number of years ago, Bono went on to say, "I met a wise man who changed my life. In countless ways, large and small, I was always seeking the Lord's blessing on my work and my life.
And this wise man said, stop. He said, stop asking God to bless what you're doing. Get involved in what God is already doing because it's already blessed. Jesus says, you want to see me? If I be lifted up, look at the cross. The cross is God's commitment in Jesus Christ to suffer with and for the world, to demonstrate that the way of truth, the way of transformation, the way of justice, the way of service, the way of love comes by way of taking into yourself personally, up close, the woundedness of ourselves and the world, and living out of that peaceful, grace-filled way to transform the world. Not out of violence, not out of anger, not out of aggression. It is the poets and the singers and the artists and the dreamers who can lift us out of the fog of our preoccupation with that which is in our life, separates us from the cross. Up close, but how personal will we be? May the Spirit of God bring us close. Amen.